Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk is entitled Vivid and Insubstantial by Lama Adam Berner. Ourselves and everything we experience are both vivid and insubstantial. Fixation on either one alone inevitably leads to suffering. Lasting happiness can be achieved through cultivating stable awareness of the inseparability of vividness and insubstantiality as it aligns our relative view with the way things really are. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Thanks, everybody, for being here. So I learned a new phrase from Lama Tom yesterday called subject spread. I don't know if that's his invention, but I love the word because that's where I found myself this week, because sometimes, like, there's something you want to talk about, and then you start to think about all the things that are connected to it and what could be, like, a really clear and concise path to a certain, you know, important topic becomes just a cloud of ideas, you know, and the more you try to make it fit, right, it just gets bigger and bigger. So it can be a little bit overwhelming, like all the details, all the ideas, all the things that you think matter, you know, just get bigger and bigger and bigger. And it actually led me back to kind of a place where I was where I first got out of retreat, which is when I first started giving talks for KTC, online. It was all on Zoom, so I was comfortable, you know, in my living room on the computer. I didn't have to really adjust to public speaking. You know, this is actually pretty new to me, getting up in front of people and talking like this. So I tried to take the approach that I saw a lot of the teachers that I admire take, which is speaking extemporaneously, you know, just kind of having an idea and going with it. And I really made the effort to do that on all my initial talks. I would just make a little bit of an outline and just go. And I learned a lot about myself in terms of, like, my fears and stuff. Like, I don't like silence. And if I'm speaking extemporaneously, I find myself speeding up, you know, not leaving pauses, like, kind of afraid that, like, in that pause, I don't know what would happen, but it's, you know, daunting. And so the last two talks I gave here, I kind of ended up on the other end of the spectrum because I was nervous about coming in here and talking, and so I wrote it all out, like pretty much everything, just basically scripted. And I was able to put all the pauses where I wanted and had the jokes, you know, inserted and prepared in advance, and all the spontaneity was orchestrated, you know. And then the last time during the question section, I found like I was just being myself answering questions because I didn't have a script. And I was like, I gotta get back to that, you know? Like, so this week when I had that subject spread, I just realized, like, this is too many details, you know, too much planning. It's cramping my style and it's not helping, you know? So I need to at least move back in the direction of some spontaneity, you know, and giving in and actually embracing a little bit of the mystery, you know, of what can happen, you know? And that's something that I love in art, you know, that's like the music I like, the theater I like, you know, like improvisational music, jazz, fish, all that kind of stuff. Like, I wanna just go feeling like, I don't know what's gonna happen, you know, and being excited about that, even if it's not exactly what I want. You know, like, I like the little bit of the danger in that, you know? So I wanna be able to do that as I deliver talks too, like where we kind of, there's like a little flow of energy happening and we end up with something together that's kind of our own creation. So that's kind of where I threw the dice on today, you know? So I've got a little outline again and we're just gonna go, which is cool. It gets me back towards, I think, a little bit of courage that we all could try to work into our lives, you know? I think a lot of times our negative emotions that come up are in response to hopes or fears or expectations that aren't met. And there's a planning that needs to be done, for sure. But there has to be some kind of balance. There has to be some kind of middle way. And so a lot of times I think we'll find ourselves on one end of the spectrum or the other. We're either too rigid and planned out and, you know, filled with expectations and thinking we've got it all covered, or we just aren't paying enough attention to anything and we're just kind of floating along hoping that the good stuff will happen but not doing anything responsible to bring it about. So this actually relates to what the core of what I wanted to talk today, which is vivid and insubstantial, which is one of the ways that we describe our deity meditation practices, visualization practices. That's maybe the most important instruction when we visualize Buddhist deities like Chenrezig, and self-visualize as the embodiment of compassion, Chenrezig. It's that instruction that the form is vivid, but insubstantial. And we also say like made of light. So you can see it, but it's not solid, you know? And that approach of remembering vivid and insubstantial, both, in every aspect of our life is extremely powerful, especially when we're suffering. So let's just start there, and then we'll chant the refuge prayer together. And the refuge prayer is like one of those ways of like, we're setting an intention. This is like a conscious, mindful way of moving forward to create positive circumstances for ourselves and other beings. So we'll chant this together. We'll do once in Tibetan, once in English, and once in Tibetan. O Sangye Chidang Soki Chodnam La Janchu Padu Dagni Kyapsu Chi Daki Jin Soki Pe Sunam Ki Drola Penchi Sangye Drupasho. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly most excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment. By the merit of generosity and other good deeds, may I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. O Sangye Chidang Soki Chodnam La Janchu Padu Dagni Kyapsu Chi Daki Jin Soki Pe Sunam Ki Drola Penchi Sangye Drupasho. I'll say a quick prayer of my own. Alden Sawe Lama Rinpoche Daki Chiwo Pele Den Chula Kadun Shempo Gone Je Zunte Kusun Tuking Yudrup Saldu So. So I think a good place to start anything is thinking a little bit about the Four Noble Truths. So just to recap briefly, the Buddha's first teaching and the foundational teaching, everything else is some exposition basically of that initial teaching. And that teaching was that suffering is a part of life and that we need to understand that. That's what we need to understand. Like what that means, the discomfort and the suffering. And that that suffering is most often experienced as just a mild discomfort that makes us wanna shift something slightly, you know? Like it's this urge to constantly adjust stuff so that our comfort is just right. And it can also be the big stuff, and it is the big stuff too, but where we see it most often and where our opportunities are to work with it are in noticing those little moments of discomfort that are somehow driving us or propelling us with this need to change something. Often minor stuff, right? Like the most easy example is reaching for your phone because you can't be present with your thoughts, you know, like, and I think most of us do that. But then the second noble truth was that that suffering has a cause, and that cause is fixation or clinging, primarily to the idea of a self. And The Buddha said that that's what we need to abandon. So to be really clear, like, we need to get rid of the cause of the suffering. And there's where the mistake is frequently made, that we're trying to get rid of the suffering, but not addressing the cause of that suffering. And so we need to understand the suffering to really understand its cause, like to really believe that that fixation and that grasping, primarily to the idea of a self, self-identity, is the cause of suffering. And then if we can abandon that, the Buddha said that the only thing we need to achieve is the cessation of suffering. That's the only thing that needs to be achieved. And that there is a path to do that. And that path is the only thing we need to rely on. And I think that those like verbs are really what makes this into what some of us might call like a science of mind and a process, you know. If we just believe that suffering is a part of life, that's kind of leaning towards the religion side of it. And that's not awful, but it takes away a lot of the benefit of the Buddha's path, you know, which is coming to understand this stuff and really getting to know it as our own truth, not somebody else's that we're just buying. We see it in our own life when we start to understand suffering. And similarly, when we contemplate these ideas of abandoning abandoning attachment to the self, like, what does that mean? And working with that and asking ourselves over and over, like, am I doing that? What does that mean for me? You know, where do I see this suffering arising and how can I let it go? And similarly, like, recognizing that there's only really one thing we need to achieve, which is the end of that discomfort, and that there's a path to do it. And if we're going to rely on anything, that's what we rely on. So the fixation, that clinging to the idea of a self, really arises because of a basic ignorance of the way things are. And in my last talk, I think we talked a little bit about that idea of like thinking things are permanent, thinking things are independent, thinking things are singular, you know, like anything is its own singular entity. You know, like that's actually kind of a mistaken view, even though it's our habitual view of stuff. We don't recognize that things are always changing. They're impermanent. A lot of times when we think of impermanent, we think of like major events of something changing. But there's also this subtle impermanence that's always going on. Like we're always aging. Things are always decaying that have come together. Things are always in this state of change, but we don't recognize that normally. We have some assumption that stuff stays the same. Similarly, we have some assumption that anything is like its own independent thing, when in fact, everything is the coming together of different causes and conditions. The common analogy for that is like a seed or a tree, you know, the idea that like, it's not just that the seed leads to the tree. It's like there's a whole, you know, constellation of causes and conditions that are coming together for that seed. There's the nutrition in the soil where the seed falls. There's where the seed falls. Did it fall under a rock? What kind of nutrients are in that soil? And then each of those causes leads to a whole other web of things, you know, like what made that soil nutrient rich in order to feed that tree? You know, like what course of events and a whole other set of things led to that? And that's how everything arises. That's how we arise. That's how our idea of the self arises, is this collection of different things that have happened to us and different things we've learned. And we'll leave here today different people than when we walked in, you know, because we'll have some different ideas about stuff. And so that this basic idea of not understanding how things really are causes us to freak out a little bit, you know, which again, kind of relates to how I was feeling walking in here today with just a brief set of notes and not my script, you know. This is a little bit of an exercise for me, and thank you for allowing me to do it in front of you, you know, to like get comfortable with, you know, just a little bit of uncertainty. So because of this fixation on the self, we freak out a little bit. We cling to this idea of self-identity in the face of any uncertainty, really. That's where we start to close off and we start to cling on to our ideas of who we are and what we can handle and what we're capable of and what other people should do in relation to us. And so this fixation is a problem. And the Buddha taught that the process of getting rid of these negative emotions, which lead to negative actions, and then become the causes of future suffering. The Buddha taught that the process of abandoning those kleshas begins with something called distancing. And that means recognizing that the negative emotions, which is kleshas in Sanskrit, recognizing that they're a problem. Not just theoretically, but remembering that all the time. So there's kind of two aspects here. There's the like recognizing it for ourselves. I mean, it's easy to say, of course, negative emotions are bad. They're called negative. But how does that work in our life? You know, how does that look in our life? What things do we do habitually that we think are us that are actually negative emotions, perpetuating negative patterns? You know, there's some classic examples of this, these types of things, you know, attachment, aversion, and like any kind of like bewilderment or ignoring. Those are what we call the three poisons. But there's also pride and jealousy and all kinds of other things that we do, seemingly naturally, you know, really habitually. But we think a lot of times that these things we've learned are us, and we're kind of defined by how we react to certain situations, you know. Even just like the food is like that. If you go somewhere and there's food you like, you're like, yeah, you know. And if there's stuff you don't like, you're, oh, I'll eat it, but, you know, I really don't like Brussels sprouts, you know. So there's all these little points in our life where we have these attachment and aversion things arise, or just ignorance. And we kind of think that's who we are. And it gives us some perverse comfort to check in with those things, you know, to kind of see like, yeah, I'm still me because I still don't like the Brussels sprouts, you know. So to get to that idea again about vividness, in the Hinayana vehicle, Tibetan Buddhism is broken into like three paths, or three what we call vehicles. And they're not separate. Like in here in KTC, we teach all three. And once you work on the Hinayana, you move to the Mahayana. And the Mahayana includes the Hinayana. And similarly, the Vajrayana includes the Mahayana and the Hinayana. So in a way, we're kind of working on all these at the same time. But we do, for the sake of like talking about them, break them into three things. And so the first approach, the Hinayana approach, I think can be kind of related to the vividness aspect, because it's about understanding our situation via what it seems to be. We take what happens and we look at it, you know, who we are and the way phenomena is, and we kind of take it for granted that there, you know, we just don't really examine, is that stuff really real? We kind of go with the idea that, yeah, it does seem like there's a self and it does seem like there's stuff happening, so what's really going on? And that's where we talk about, in particular, interdependence, that idea we talked about a moment ago. We talk about karma, which is habit energy, you know, tendencies, propensities. So, for instance, the last hour in here was shamatha meditation. And in shamatha meditation, we work with watching our thoughts, you know, see, or we place our attention on the breath. And when we notice that we're thinking, we bring our attention back to the breath. And in doing that, we start to see how we react to divergences from things that we want to do. You know, in a session of meditation, we have the intention of placing the attention on the breath, but then we get distracted. We think about work, we think about dinner, we think about lunch, we think about what the person said to us the other day, and then how do we come back from that? You know, do we get upset? Are we angry? Do we think we're like not competent meditators because all of a sudden we had a thought in the middle of a meditation session? Or do we recognize that we'll always have thoughts arising? And we just are able to gently bring our attention back to the breath again with some kindness and with some, maybe a little bit of humor and patience too. And that is a place where we start to see our habits. That's, you know, what we see on the cushion relates directly to what we do throughout the whole rest of our day. And that's a really important piece of the path, is recognizing that what comes up on the cushion is not an isolated event. You know, like there's a reason why these practices are skillful. They call up our own styles of attachment. They call up our own habits. And so we need to pay attention to that and think about like, how do those things that are happening on the cushion apply to, you know, my relationship at home, you know, or my relationship at work, or how I am on the, in traffic, you know, like, because these things do, you know, they are related. So the practice of shamatha helps us to begin to see our relationship with both a practical goal, placing attention on the breath, and the reality, the unknown reality that surrounds it, you know, kind of just this open ground where whatever, you know, comes up in our mind just appears. And it seems like where is this coming from? You know, like, it's kind of strange that we're pretty sure who we are, but what happens in our mind is like someone else is putting it together, right? Like, we don't get to pick what shows up in our mind in a session of meditation. But that's what we tend to relate with, is this seemingly chaotic stream of thoughts that we aren't really in charge of, you know, like where we should be moving that self-identification to is that open aspect of the practice, that aware aspect of the practice, the aspect that notices things as they are, that sees them and then makes kind, patient adjustments, you know, with a little bit of humor. That's really more who we are, is that open aspect. It's not each of those impermanent, surprising thoughts that come up in a session of shamatha. So last time I was here, I talked about the commitment to do no harm and the idea of refraining reflectively. So like when we don't do something, having some awareness of what it feels like to not do that. And we talked about it in specific with the idea of the pratimoksha vows, which are like not to kill, not to steal, not to lie, and how when we engage in a practice of refraining, we will feel the discomfort. And that is that discomfort that the Buddha was talking about. Like, we're actually engaging with it a little bit and coming to understand it better and not reflexively jumping to a distraction or ignoring, you know? Like, we're not giving in to the attachment to a perfectly wonderful session of meditation. We're not giving in to the aversion of like getting angry when there is a thought. And we're not giving in to the ignorance of just not paying any attention. So then when we get into the Mahayana, the second cycle of the Buddha's teaching, I think that emphasizes more of the insubstantial aspect. In that now we do start to look at how things really are. We do start to look at, like, you know, what is the nature of my mind and what is the nature of phenomena. And we're taught that nature is empty or limitless or voidness. And the idea there is that empty does not mean there's nothing there. It just means that we can't find anything in there that is the essence of what it is. So for instance, a common example is like a table. You know, like if you have a table, you've got the top of the table, and you've got the legs, and if you take the legs off and break the top of the table in half, like, where's the table? You know, you can say those are the pieces of the table, but is there anything in there that is table? I mean, these are the kind of things we have to contemplate. Like, there's nothing in any part of a table that is a table. You know, it's just a collection of things that have come together. And actually, the older example is like a chariot. You know, like if you take all the wheels off and the axle and all that stuff, like, where's the chariot in there? And then similarly, we think about ourselves, you know, the physical body, you know, like, what part of your physical body is me? You know, like, if you lost all your limbs, would you still be you? You know, if you lost your head too, would you still be you? You know, like, where in you, in the physical body, is you? Are you the same person if those things change? You know, I think where when you do this type of analysis, you find there is no part of your body that you can physically say is you, you know, is me. But then we may say, well, it's the mind, you know. And if you look at the mind, then you start to say, what's that? You know, where in the mind is what I might call the mind? You know, I have this string of, like we talked about, seemingly random thoughts that comes up. I have this awareness. I have a lot of feelings and habits and things like that. I'm learning new things all the time, you know, so I forget things all the time. But it still seems like there's a me in there, but you can't really put your finger on where you are in there. You know, like, this is a collection. This is a changing collection, a process that just for convenience, we call me, you know, we call it a self. And we kind of have to do that to get around in the world. Like that's how, you know, we have relationships and jobs, and we've got to do that to some degree. And then maybe surprisingly, the commitment that's related with that vehicle is the commitment to take care of one another. I said maybe surprisingly, because if we're saying that there's no essence to ourselves or phenomena, like why do we then have to go take care of each other? And the idea is because we suffer from the ignorance of not knowing who we really are. That's where those negative emotions come from. And everybody's in that state. So we learn a little bit about this stuff and we start to try to integrate it. And we do these really skillful practices, you know, shamatha. And in the Mahayana, we'd be talking about like the practice of taking and sending, tonglen. That's taught the fifth Sundays of each month here, the compassion meditation class. And we generate this compassion because we recognize that we're all in this same boat. Like we're all mistaking the way things really are. And we're all not seeing the actual nature of things. And because of that, we're reacting habitually again and again. And really the only thing we can do in that situation is start to cultivate some compassion for each other. And some understanding that we're all facing the same fundamental issue. And another aspect of the practice of taking and sending and cultivating compassion is that we start to kind of blur the boundaries between self and other. We start to see that they're illusory, you know, that they're imagined, and that they're habitually cultivated. You know, the more we believe in them and the more we react because of them, the stronger they seem. But there's nothing real there. You know, there's no there there. And then to the degree that we become familiar with our own suffering, like our own ways of not seeing our nature or understanding how things actually arise, and then reacting habitually with negative emotions and negative action, thereby creating more suffering. To the degree that we become familiar with that process in ourselves, we become better able to be present with others who are suffering. We start to see that like their suffering is like ours, and that we understand when they get seemingly upset for no reason, you know? Like they have a certain quirk or they have a certain need and they feel like that's who they are, and you know, they're acting in ways that may be not beneficial to them or to other people or to large groups of people, you know. But at the end of the day, there's the same mistake happening. And so beginning to just simply be present with our own suffering and then recognizing that other people are going through the same issues, we become able to be comfortable not only with ourselves and our situation, but with others and their suffering. And we can cultivate compassion and actually be better able to be there with people when they're suffering. That's one of the best reasons, really, I think, to do the practice of taking and sending. And anyone who works with people on a regular basis, which is probably all of us in some way or another, that's a super useful practice, you know. Healthcare, customer service, you know, like there's all these situations where like we can become quite angry with the way other people are behaving. And that causes us problems, you know, and we can be more skillful in being able to at least understand the suffering they're having. We don't have to endorse bad behavior or stand by for it, but we can at least start to see that there's an empty nature to that. Like it's not as solid as we think. Just because someone else feels like their feelings are real solid, we don't have to join that delusion, you know? And that's usually what happens when we encounter suffering or anger or pride or things that, you know, these negative emotions, when we encounter them, we tend to like mimic them, you know? We feel almost like we have to. If somebody yells at you, there's a real strong urge to yell back, you know? And that's, we don't have to. And so beginning to understand our own sort of insubstantial nature and their insubstantial nature and the insubstantiality of even the idea of self or other helps us to be present with others more effectively. And then when we get into the practices and ideas of the Vajrayana, the third turning of the Buddha, the wheel of Dharma, we start to put the vivid and the insubstantial together. And this is starting to understand our situation via the union of what we see and what's the real truth. You know, like we obviously see stuff happening. We obviously have this idea that there's a self and that there's other, and we experience that. Experience goes on, even when we recognize, to some degree, conceptually, that the ultimate nature of things is empty. And there's a balance that has to be struck between what we see, you know, and what we experience, and the ultimate empty nature of that stuff. And in this way, like all phenomena and all experience can be a sacred path to awakening. I mean, nothing is excluded. And that's the real beauty of Vajrayana, or the Tantrayana is another name for that. And Tantra actually just means continuity, or like a thread. Like there's a thread of sacredness that runs through everything, everything. And nothing can be excluded. Nothing should be excluded, nothing can be excluded. It is all a path. And the commitment that's related with that is usually the Samaya vow of the Vajrayana. And without getting too far into that, I think we can say that it's really the acceptance that we're bound to our experience, that we're bound to what we encounter in every moment. And I mean bound in a positive way, like that's our path, that's our results arising, that's our experience, that's our avenue to awakening, is what comes up in every moment. In the practice of Chenrezig, when we do the mantra section, the mantra recitation, the idea there is one of the things we can be doing is trying to cultivate what we call the threefold bearing. And that is that this idea of recognizing everything that we see, all form, as being like the body of the teacher. You know, so everything we see is the teacher. And everything that we hear is a sacred sound or mantra. And that the nature of all thought is enlightened wisdom. Not necessarily what we're thinking, but the nature of what we're thinking is enlightened wisdom. So in that way, we see everything as the teacher, and everything that we encounter can be an avenue, you know, and our riches for learning, you know, our particular gift for learning. And I say gift, but I'm also talking about the stuff that we hate, you know, like the stuff that we don't want to encounter. Like those are our specific jewels, really, for finding our own awakening. And it's only through working with everything, with nothing excluded, that we can really do that. Yesterday we did the a Nunye event here, you know, and one thing we talked about, because Nunye is a difficult practice, complex, a lot of stuff going on. It's ritual is a common aspect of Vajrayana practices, so there's a lot of like rules and doing this and that, certain hand gestures, and you got to do this when you come in the room and don't do that, and it's tough to remember all that stuff, and we can get a little hung up on the details, you know, we can get a little hung up on wanting to do it perfectly. But I think one of the best things about working with practices like that as a new person is you have a unique opportunity to work with what it feels like to encounter something that you don't understand. And it's difficult, and you're committed to figuring out. And most of the time, we don't like that. Like that's not, I mean, like we're opting into it with tantric practices in ritual. We opt into to this engaging with something that is complex, and frankly, that we're going to feel inept at for a while. Like it's going to feel like we don't know what we're doing, and we're going to have some discomfort there, you know. But we work with it, you know. We commit to doing it, and we engage and we are present with that feeling. We refrain from exiting. You know, we also don't cling on to the need for everything to be perfect. And so we have this balance of, in that way, it's sort of like a balance of vivid and insubstantial. You know, like we want to do things right, but we also recognize that ultimately, like, it's just going to be our experience, like what it is. Like, how do we conduct ourselves in a way that keeps us awake without causing more suffering for ourselves and others? How do we not re-engage with negative habits? Now, I frequently give rise to negative emotions in rituals. And I think most of us probably do, because there's so much to bring up our attachments there. You know, like there's so much, that's one of the reasons that Tantra is such an incredible spiritual technology. It is sneaky in the way it works. You know, like we kind of think that, like, you know, pouring the water here is the thing, you know, but the thing is what's happening in your mind when you spill that water, you know, or what happens when you, you know, mispronounce something, or maybe everybody else stops chanting and you're the last one, like, oh, oh. You know, those moments that are a little bit embarrassing, but they happen, you know. And for me, a lot of times it'll be feeling like I know what's right. Like somebody told me how to do something, and I see someone else in the room doing it a different way, and I start quietly judging, you know, like they don't know what they're doing. I know what I'm doing, you know. Side note, in those cases, one thing I found is that in almost every case, someone's told people to do something a certain way. And it was probably their teacher, and it was probably right in the context of what they were doing. So that's another funny thing about ritual, is like there's a right way, but the right way is the way you're told, your teacher told you to do it. And even in this shrine room, when we do practices together, you'll see people doing things different ways. And that's okay, you know, because the ritual is about what's coming up for you. You know, how are you engaging with the practice and what's going on in your mind? So when we visualize Chenrezig or any tantric deity, they're an embodiment of our own qualities. So we visualize Chenrezig, the embodiment of compassion, and a lot of times we have a frontal visualization, but we also self-visualize as these deities. We self-visualize as the embodiment of compassion. And we create a visualization that is vivid. We try to make sure we can see each detail. You know, we might start just with like moving from the top of the head down. You know, we might just kind of imagine, take a look at the top knot, you know, the little jewel on the top of his head, and then look away and just try to recall that in our mind. You know, and then we might go back and look at the next two that are below it and the knot of black hair in there, you know, and then we visualize that. And the instruction is usually to work from the top down and then back up again. But you can also just try to visualize the whole form in general. You know, maybe you do details and then kind of zoom out, do the whole body. But at every point in that practice, we're trying to recall that we're not making the deity solid. You know, we're not, and that's what's different, because when we see stuff in the room right now, you know, we think stuff is solid. And we kind of think everything's solid all the time. But that's, we know from what we've already talked about that that's actually not the state of things. Things are always changing. Things are collections. We can even think of that from a science perspective, right? Because you know how much space is in an atom, right? Like it's like a long way from the nucleus to the next like proton or electron, right? So we know that nothing's actually really solid, but we really think it is. So when we do these practices of like Chenrezig, we're trying to remember that things are insubstantial. Like there's no solidity to a deity like that. And we do a frontal visualization, which we interact with, and that helps us to understand phenomena, you know, as they really are. It helps us to understand that like what we see and hear appears, but is insubstantial. And then we do a self-visualization, which helps us understand our relative view as it actually is. We visualize ourself as the embodiment of compassion. And it can feel contrived, you know, in the beginning, for sure. And maybe even like a little fake. But the idea is that our sense of limitation, our sense of having this very centralized view of a self-identity and a need to protect our territory and get everything to fit our preferences and all that, like, that's all wrong view, you know? I mean, what the Buddha taught is that we all have this innate potential for unlimited wisdom and compassion. Unlimited. And part of the way we work with that in the compassion meditation is recognizing that our wish for others to be happy and our wish for them not to suffer is enough, whether it's for one person or all beings. You know, if it's one person, I mean, we have a hard enough time, I think, sometimes with the people close enough, like really just doing what we can to make sure they're happy and not suffering. Like, it's difficult even just to work with one person. But through the practice of taking and sending, we engage in a practice where we are able to start to see that that innate loving kindness and compassion is enough for everybody, all beings. Like, we can include all beings in that wish for happiness and not to suffer. And our loving kindness and compassion, which is how we talk about that in Buddhism, loving kindness is the wish for others to be happy and have the causes of happiness, and compassion is the wish for them not to suffer or to create the causes of further suffering. Those things are important because we want people to be happy now, but we also don't want them to be in the process of being happy creating causes of suffering, you know? So we need to think not only about what's happening now, but what we're doing in terms of what's going to happen in the future. So another common part of the practice of deity meditation is once we've created this visualization, this visualization of ourself that's actually much closer to the truth, which is really where I was going here, because like we have this idea that we're limited, but we have to recognize that we have this open, wise, compassionate nature, and we have to start to habituate in that direction. So we have habitual things we're doing all the time. We need to start making the right kind of habits, you know? And one of the ways we create those is remembering that we have this unlimited wisdom and compassion. Even just remembering is a good place to start. And so it's actually closer to the real truth to visualize ourselves as these, as deities like Chenrezig, and to think of ourselves and other people in that way, both because there's that acknowledgement of unlimited wisdom and compassion, and also because there's this acknowledgement that what we see is insubstantial. We see it, but it's insubstantial. It's insubstantial, but we see it. And so it's an and, you know? I mean, I was thinking about this yesterday. I may have to retract this, but I feel like it has to be an and relationship, you know? Vivid and insubstantial. It's not like vivid but insubstantial, because it's both. You know, they're two aspects of the same thing. Things do appear, but they appear because they're insubstantial. And because things are insubstantial, things can appear and change and interact. If they weren't insubstantial, they couldn't do that. If things were really solid and what they were and independent, there would be no change in interaction and all that stuff. So it's only because of that insubstantial aspect that we can have the vividness. And it's only because of the vividness that we can find that insubstantiality. We see that things are changing, and we see that there is no essence to stuff. So it is a vivid and insubstantial relationship. And at the end of these practices, we usually dissolve our self-visualization. We just dissolve it into emptiness. But that emptiness isn't nothing. You know, we do that disillusion, and it's not like all of a sudden lights out, you know, like you're still right there, you know. Ideally, you have a little gap where you're right there with no reference point. You're just there with experience and awareness, and you can just rest there without clinging back to that idea of a self. Pretty quickly, we're going to cling back to the idea of a self. And that's okay, because that's been our habit for a long, long, long time. But we start to train. We're training, you know, and we're starting to see, you know, we do these practices that are really, really skillful, and we start to see that that's actually the way things are. And in particular, we start to build the confidence that we can interact with a vivid world, you know, that is also insubstantial, and we can remember both of those things. And we can have a process of awareness and experience that isn't necessarily tied to a self-identity or isn't necessarily defined by who we are and what it is. So that emptiness that we rest in at the end is also awareness. It's vivid. And then what we do, as soon as we have some sort of dualistic thought, some thought based on any conceptuality or ourself, is we re-arise. We re-arise as the deity. So we kind of let the whole visualization go. We dissolved into emptiness. And then instead of coming back as the person who's annoyed that I just had a thought in the midst of this incredibly relaxing meditation, I come back as Chen Reisik. You know, I come back with that unlimited compassion and the recognition of vivid and insubstantial. Vividness and insubstantiality, inseparable. And then it's with that frame of mind that we try to attempt to re-engage the world. And this is where the idea of mandala can come in too. You know, the idea that our experience is our mandala. And it seems to us that we're in the center of it, and then there's all this stuff around us. But all the stuff in our mandala isn't in our control. What's in our control is how we react to the stuff in our mandala. And so that's kind of an interesting thing to think about when we walk around in the world. You know, that it's going to appear that we're in the center of this mandala. We can't ever really control everything that's happening in the mandala. But how we interact with that mandala is our path. You know, that is the path of vividness and insubstantiality. And that mandala is going to probably seem to be filled with what we call the eight worldly concerns. You know, our mandala is going to present us with losses and gains and pleasure and pain and ill repute and fame and praise and blame and anything else that rhymes with aim. But those are potent avenues, you know, for our awakening. And in fact, the more intense those things are, the more potent an opportunity they are. We often think that these disruptions too, or intrusions on our perfect mandala, you know, we react like with, you know, distaste to those kind of things. Believing that like someone disrupting our mandala is gonna somehow keep us in ignorance or mess us up. But that's what keeps us trapped in the suffering. You know, like what keeps us trapped is not being able to work with our mandala, not recognizing it to be vivid and insubstantial, and applying some sort of antidote, you know, applying, you know, awareness or compassion, you know, in some way that can actually help us and help others. And I could go on. I think I'll just wrap up by saying, I don't know, did you guys see that mirror that they found at Cincinnati Museum of Art? Yeah, they found this like old mirror that they didn't realize that if you shined a light on it a certain way, it would shine this image of a Buddha, you know? So it's really cool. Like, and they had this thing for, I don't know, decades or something, and nobody had actually done that trick with the light. And so it shines this image up of Amitabha, you know, which sometimes you see him above Chen Reisik's head, not right there. But so it's this image of the Buddha Amitabha that shines up on the wall. And immediately I saw that this week and I was like, oh, I'm talking about that in the talk for sure. Because, I mean, that's this idea of vivid and insubstantial, right? You see the Buddha there. You see this image of the Buddha in light on the wall, but there's no Buddha there. You know, there's no, like you can't touch it. You know, there's nothing really there. That image of the Buddha is arising interdependently. You know, it's the light, it's the mirror, it's the wall, it's your eye faculty, it's your ability to see and process what it is. Like there's all these factors of interdependence that have come together to make that Buddha visible on the wall. And that Buddha is vivid, but insubstantial. There's nothing there. But it appears. And I had there was a point in my 3-year retreat where we were having a lot of conflict in the house, a lot of problems, and it was really, really challenging time. And I got some of the best advice I'd ever gotten from Lama Yeshe Japso, who was one of our retreat mates. And he taught me that, he said, he wrote it out because we were in Vajrayogini and we weren't talking. So he had a dry erase board and wrote out that basically that like when we suffer, it's usually because we're too attached, too fixated to the vividness of the situation or the insubstantiality of the situation. And that's pretty heavy. And I've been able to see that now in a lot of parts of my life, you know, like when I do find myself suffering a lot, feeling tense, you know, something's not right, you know, like, it's been really helpful to me to think, like, you know, what am I clinging to here? You know, is it the seeming reality of the appearance, you know, or is it the seeming reality of, like, you know, insubstantiality alone, you know, that, like, the things are just insubstantial? One way or the other, we suffer. So I think that's maybe the best place to stop, because that's been really beneficial to me, and I think that's a really practical instruction we can take into the world with us. In terms of formal practice, you know, we teach shamatha here, we teach taking and sending, and we teach deity meditation. So these are all three formal practices that you could learn here in classes or one-on-one with one of our meditation teachers or lamas, and I highly recommend that. I mean, that path of interacting with a teacher who knows you and you know them, and you're able to talk about your own experiences and your own doubts and your own questions one-on-one is really like the root of this whole lineage. You know, that's how everything has come down. So I highly recommend engaging in that kind of path or practice. And we have a little time for questions if anybody wants to ask anything. I will do my best to answer.
Thank you for your talk, Lama Adam. I like your style.
Thank you.
So when you were discussing the Mahayana path relative to insubstantiality, and you discussed that as you can gain this universal wisdom, right, of insubstantiality, it leads you to the natural conclusion of compassion and loving kindness, and that makes sense to me. Last week, Lama Kathy taught in the 7-point mind training that if you gain the wisdom of that without compassion and loving kindness, that could be disastrous. And that makes sense to me, but I can't reconcile those two concepts, right? Could you say a little bit about that?
Sure. I think I guess what you're saying is, like, so to repeat, you get the idea that like understanding emptiness leads to compassion. But if you were to understand emptiness without compassion,
correct.
Why is that a problem?
Or how do you reconcile those two things? How could you understand emptiness without compassion?
Okay. Well, I mean, I think the short answer is that our experience is vivid and insubstantial. So if you were getting the insubstantiality without the vividness, you're going to suffer because the vividness is going to keep on coming. You know, and the only way to interact with that, so another way to say it would be that like the skillful means of working with the vividness is compassion. That's how we navigate the details and the lucidity and all that aspect of our existence is with compassion. That's the way that we interact with the details. But there is a saying, like I think Saraha said, that like the person who doesn't understand emptiness is an idiot, and the person who thinks emptiness is real is like a real idiot. I'm paraphrasing, but I'm paraphrasing for sure. But the idea being that like we can't just forego engaging with the vivid aspect. We can't just forego engaging with what arises from that insubstantiality. And that's actually what leads us to would be called nihilism, you know, just thinking that nothing really matters.
Yep, and when you speak of clinging to insubstantiality, that is what you speak of?
Yeah, like if you were to just like be enraptured with emptiness, yeah. You know?
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Anyone else?
I always learn at least one thing, often more, coming here. However, there's this issue of forgetfulness. But today you've shared the scripted spontaneity, and I shall remember that. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Hey, Lama Adam. You might not remember me. I worked with you briefly a few years ago. My name's also Adam. Yes. Yeah. We worked together, and then we didn't, but that was my fault, none of your own. But no, I just wanted to use this time to say that I thought you did a wonderful job today, and there was so much to take in, to remember. The one thing I am going to take from this is the being kind, patient, with a little bit of humor. You know, I'm going to use that for the rest of the day, and I'm just hope to get to know you better and to work with you again. Like I said, I've been gone for a few years, but I'm back. So.
Absolutely.
Thank you
Good
so much.
Good to see you again, Adam. Thank you. Thanks. Maybe we have time for one more if there are any.
So this is related to the talk that Kenpo Ujin did a couple of weeks ago.
Okay.
Something that I just thought about, which was that one of the things that I've learned is in my meditation is, and from what you've taught, is recognizing that the self is illusory, that that we shouldn't get too attached to our imaginations of who we think we are. But it seems to me that there's a very fine line between recognizing that the self is illusory and then sort of devolving into a self-hatred, a hatred of the self, a sort of bitterness against the ego, which seems to me like it would reinforce it. So I just wanted your thoughts on that.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think you used two words in there, like self and ego. So I think like ego is where we direct our, if we're gonna direct disdain anywhere, it's to the ego, you know? And there are methods like that is taught as part of like Lojong, you know, like actually like kind of speaking, I don't wanna say rudely, like, what's the word you use?
Scolding
the ego, you know, like for all the trouble it causes us, you know, because it really does. It's the ego being this, you know, sense of, there's two ways of talking about the ego. Like one way is like, it's what keeps us kind of centered in self-identity. Another really cool definition I've heard Pema Chodron use is it's the part of us that resists what is. So I like that one a lot too. But so the ego is a problem, you know, and that's, and it's kind of okay to tell it like, I'm not playing your game anymore, you know, but the idea of the self, though, I think that, like, that latent sense that there is a self, like, that's what we work on with deity meditation. That's what we start to identify with. If we're going to identify with something in our relative view, it should be this sense that we are vivid and insubstantial, and our nature is unlimited wisdom and compassion. And that, of course, is wonderful, you know, and doesn't need to be denigrated in any way. But so that's kind of what we do with that sense that there's a self at that line where you said we could take it into like self-denigration. Instead, we say, no, I'm going to recognize what it really is and, you know, think of it in that way and train in that way. So that's a good question because it would be a problem to go, you know, the route of self-denigration.
Yes. Cool. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you, Ivan. All right, it's 12:30, so we should chant the dedication and move into our realms vividly and insubstantially. So we'll chant in English. By this merit, may all obtain omniscience. May it defeat the enemy wrongdoing. From the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may I free all beings. The courageous Manjushri, who knows everything as it is, Samantabhadra, who also knows in the same way, and all the bodhisattvas, that I may follow in their path, I completely dedicate all this virtue. And let's just sit for a moment. Thank you, everybody. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.